invite you to Matthew chapter 24. We're continuing the Sermon on the Mount, at least these nine Beatitudes as expressed. I've called this the Kingdom Blessings for the Righteous. And we are in the second Beatitude, which is in verse 4 of that chapter, chapter 5. Just want to remind you that when Jesus comes on the scene, the nation of Israel are in darkness. We saw this prophesied in the end of chapter 8 in Isaiah, going into chapter 9, and that's going to be quoted in the preceding chapter, chapter 4, in verses 15 and 16. Isaiah the prophet, a land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, this is northern Israel in the area of Galilee, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. Upon those who sat in the region in the shadow of death, light has dawned. And at that moment, Jesus began to preach and say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Evidence of this salvation was seen in the physical form, in the sense that he had the power over death. He had power over diseases, which sin causes. The answer to this great question, why is there evil? It's because of sin. And therefore, in verses 23 and 24, as he's preaching in the synagogues, the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of diseases among the people, his fame went everywhere, and they followed him. And so we see this multitude in verse 1 of chapter 5. And Jesus is on the mount. He calls his particular disciples, those 12 closer to him, and begins to open his mouth and teach them. Now, the Sermon on the Mount, in fact, which encompasses three chapters, chapter 5 to 7, deals what it means to be a believer. So the characteristic of the believer will be seen in these three chapters. He will deny false righteousness, men's works, and any human effort that men will try to accomplish. It is a work of God. And therefore, he begins the first beatitude by saying, blessed. And that can be translated happy or fortunate, are the poor in spirit. These are people that are spiritually bankrupt. They see their need before God. They have nothing to offer God. And until you get to that place and see your brokenness, you can't be saved. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. These connect themselves together. They're not disjointed. The fact that one had humbled themselves, understanding their spiritual destitution, call upon God through faith, and God saves. These are people, in that second beatitude, verse 4, they are blessed, those who mourn, who lament, who grieve, who have sorrow, those who cry out, that are sad, for they shall be comforted. Psalm 55, David cries out this type of attitude in verses 6 and 8 in that chapter, Psalm 55. Oh, that I had wings like a dove, and I would fly away to be at rest. Behold, I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness. I would hasten to my place of refuge from the stormy wind and tempests. You get what David's saying? He's having a hard time. It's very difficult. I want to go to a place of refuge, like a bird that can fly away, and I can find peace. Well, that's the cry that comes from the lips of almost just about everybody on the earth at one time or another. So David echoes the cry of humanity, a cry of release, a cry of freedom, a cry to escape from the things that weigh us down. When you and I face great sorrow or disappointment or tragedy or failure, we wish we could escape. We wish we could go somewhere else. This could be behind us. Like a thunderstorm, we could run inside for shelter. But comfort from the troubles of life, it's a lot harder to find shelter than from rain. The deeper that our sorrow and the harder that the pressure is, the worse we are in despair. Comfort seems to be elusive from us. So all these Beatitudes, even though they seem paradoxical, I mean, poor and those that mourn, those that are meek, those that are hungry and thirsty, merciful, peacemakers, persecuted. And yet, the outcome, it's not like what the world would expect. Because the promises of what they demand seems incongruous. They seem upside down in the eyes of natural man. Why should I seek as a poor person, or why should I seek as a person that mourns to find satisfaction in life and for eternity, for all the matter? So the paradox of this second beatitude, remember, happy, fortunate, blessed if you mourn. This word mourn conveys the idea of extreme sadness. It means to lament, even profusely. It's mainly used of a loss and death of a close friend or relative. And as I mentioned, it means something not just sorrowing, just to sorrow because something sad has happened. It can also mean that you're grieved over sin, over evil. You can find comfort in mourning. That's what he's saying here. And you're blessed. In the routine of ordinary day-by-day living, again, this seems absurd. And the whole structure in regards to the human being, in regards to living, whether you're sophisticated or you're primitive, whether you're wealthy or you're poor, uneducated or educated, this controversial principle that the way to happiness isn't to go your own way. That's the way of the world. Pressure or pleasure in life, the world would say, brings happiness. Money brings happiness. Entertainment brings happiness. Fame brings happiness. Praise brings happiness. Self-expression brings happiness, right? That's what we hear. But on the negative side, avoiding pain or trouble or disappointment, frustration, hardship, or other problems, that brings happiness too, right? Again, that's what the world says. Sidestepping those things, it's necessary that we understand the principles that he's talking about here. Because throughout history, a basic axiom of the world that the favorable things brings happiness and the unfavorable things brings unhappiness. So this deals with the way the world would look at it, is your circumstances or how I feel. The principle seems so self-evident that people would say, we're not even going to debate this. But Jesus said, you're happy, you're blessed, you're fortunate if you mourn, if you lament, if you sorrow, if you grieve. He went so far to say in another gospel account, Luke chapter 6, verse 25, which is a converse opposite beatitude to this one. Jesus said, woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. That will be your future and eternity. You think you're having a good time now without me? You'll have the worst time and it'll last forever and ever and ever and ever, unending. So Jesus turned the world's principle exactly upside down. He reversed the path to happiness. And to discover what Jesus means and did not mean in this particular beatitude, we're going to look at the meaning of mourning, how it's used here, the result of mourning, the way to mourn as Jesus teaches, and the way to know if I truly am mourning. Now, we can't do all this morning. What I'm going to do this morning, I'm going to talk about the meaning of mourning, and I'm going to show improper mourning and proper mourning. And that would just be the basis of what we're going to be dealing with here. Because this is something that's really misunderstood based on the premise of the things I've already talked about of how the world determines happiness. And unfortunately, the Christian has bitten into this. You have the prosperity gospel movements that have tens of thousands of people following them on these very principles. And by the way, if things aren't going well for you, you're in sin. Because if everything was going right for you, God's blessing you. And by the way, that concept was true for the Pharisees. The Pharisees felt that if you had money and wealth, and if you had children and so on, you're blessed by God. So you can take Samuel's mother out of the category here. She didn't have any children. She prayed. It was a miracle. She had a child. Zechariah and Elizabeth, in their old age, they had no children. Are they not blessed of God because they had no children? Well, that's not the case. God used that as a situation. What about Abraham and Sarah? No children. He had to use another means to have children because you couldn't have children by Sarah, at least. There was the promise that was given, and in that promise, she bore a seed through Abraham and had a child when they were beyond childbearing years. So the Pharisees taught this, and Jesus is going counter to the Pharisees. Remember, the key verse to the Sermon on the Mount is verse 20 of chapter 5. Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not religiosity. It's not trying to be holy or acceptable before God. It's seeing yourself in your state and sin and rebellion and turning from your sin humbly before God, knowing that you cannot satisfy God by anything that you do, but rather accept his offering of the gift that he gives through his son, Jesus Christ, who died on the cross. And that's why one of the reasons he was given, or why he came. The Bible describes many things the reason why Jesus came. This is just one reason. He came to seek and save those that are lost. So, the meaning of mourning. certain kinds of sorrow are common to all men, which I've already mentioned, and they're experienced by believers and unbelievers. Some sorrows are normal. Some are legitimate. Sorrows which concern the Lord, for which He knows our need. Others are abnormal or illegitimate, brought about solely because of sinful passion and objectives. So, improper mourning. Let's describe that first. Those frustrated in fulfilling evil plans and lusts, or those that are misguided in regards to their loyalties and their affections. To those who mourn in that way, the Lord offers no help or solace for you. For example, David's son, Amnon, was frustrated. He was distressed or vexed, the Bible says, because of his sister Tamar. He became sick or ill. Why? Because she was a virgin. And it was improper, or it seemed hard for Amnon to do anything with her. In other words, he was lusting for his sister. And he was stressed so much over that, grieved over that, he became sick. Can you imagine that? Amnon's grief was caused by incestual, unfulfilled lust. That's improper mourning, friend. That's improper grief. Secondly, others carry legitimate sorrow, but to illegitimate extremes. When a person grieves so hard and so long after the loss of a loved one that that person cannot function normally, and that grief becomes sinful and absolutely destructive, such depression, such sorrow is usually related to guilt, essential selfishness. For a Christian, it's a mark of unfaithfulness and a lack of trust in God. Example, David grieved that way in part to try to atone for his own guilt. When the usurping, rebellious son, Absalom, was killed, his father went into an uncontrollable, incounselable mourning. 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 33, chapter 19, verse 4, talk about this. In chapter 19 of 2 Samuel, Job finally comes up to the king. Now, I'm leaving a lot out, assuming that most of you probably know the story. I'm just hitting to the high part. Job comes to him when David's grieving. Oh, Absalom, Absalom! Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son Absalom! Job comes up to him and says, today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life. Remember, they were going after the king and kill him. And basically any of his progeny and those loyal to him. You have disgraced all your servants, David, who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and your daughters, the lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines, and that you love your enemies and you hate your friends. For you have declared that you regard neither princes nor servants, for today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, it would have pleased you well. And he told him, you better get up and you better go out there, because if you don't, a worse thing than what Absalom did is going to happen to you. In other words, Job's going to take control and he's going to destroy the kingdom of David. He's going to take it himself. The wickedly ambitious Absalom had raised a rebel army, driven the king to his who was his father, out of Jerusalem and had taken over the palace. So David's love for his son, it certainly was understandable. But his judgment was perverted, probably because of the great feeling of guilt for having been such a bad father. Because he knew that Absalom's tragedy was part of the judgment that God declared through Nathan to David because of David's adulterous, murderous affair with Bathsheba. That he was going to plague his household now. And this is part of that evidence. So that's improper mourning. What's proper mourning? Well, there are legitimate sorrows that are common to all mankind. Reasonable mourning is appropriate. And to express these sorrows, to cry over them, opens an escape valve to keep our feelings from festering and poisoning our emotions and our whole life. And it provides the way of healing. Just like washing out a wound that prevents infection. There's a Arab proverb that says, quote, "All sunshine makes a desert." End quote. So the trouble-free life is likely to be shallow life. If you're not going to go through pains in this life, your life isn't going to stand for too much. We often learn more things through our trials. We even mature, if we learn correctly, from times of sorrow, even when things are not going well. The familiar poem that Robert Browne Hamilton expressed the truth. This is what he said. Quote, "I walked a mile with pleasure. She shattered all my way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and ne'er a word she said, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me." Now, that's really the truth of what the Psalms talk about, by and large. The Bible tells us in the book of Hebrews that Jesus had to learn to obey by the things he suffered. Hebrews chapter 5. And therefore he became the perfect one. Through the trial, he was faithful. When Adam was tried, he failed. And we suffer because of that. Because technically speaking, through Adam, we also made that choice. Let's face it, when we are faced with opportunities, we have failed time and time again. Even as a Christian, we can fail. And we have failed. But what do you do with your failures? What do you do with times of sorrow? What do you do with times of trial? Do you try to run away from them? Or do you face them and trust in the Lord? And you are purged through that? James chapter 1, 1 Peter chapter 1 deals specifically with people that have a purer faith because they have been perfected by their trials. Jesus said to the Laodicea church in Revelation chapter 13, "Buy from me fire or gold that is tried by fire." And that's exactly what 1 Peter says. Genuine faith. Genuine faith has to be tested to find what sort it is. It's not just any faith. Men can produce faith. It's all over the world. But the faith that God gives is a faith that transcends that. It defies reasoning. Gives inner peace in the midst of the travesties that are going all around you. Let's look at the first one on proper meaning of mourning. a death of a loved one. Well, Sarah's death caused Abraham to mourn. Genesis 23, verse 2. He's the father of the faithful. Did he weep from a lack of faith? No. It's legitimate to mourn over a loss of a loved one. The Bible talks about loneliness for God can be a time of mourning. Separated in time. It caused the psalmist in Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2. And you can keep on reading through that, by the way. You know the psalm, as the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul inside me pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God. For the living God, not the idols that are dead, but a personal, relatable God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before Him? Now he's using the Old Testament idea of coming in the presence of God at the temple. And he's away from that. And he longs to be there and have communion with God in that place. My tears have been my food day and night. Well, they continually just say to me, where is your God? You know, when we are not in strong fellowship with God because of sin, not spending time with Him in the Word, fellowship with God's people so that we can grow, we begin to wane. We begin to get weak in our spiritual life. We begin to trip and fall. And the unbeliever looks at our life and says, where is your God? Where is your God? And so we go back in our confession. We pant, we turn, we commune with God in prayer, in His Word, in fellowship with God's people. We are strengthened. We continue to minister to the lives of other people. I see your God. A third proper way of anguish or sorrow or mourning is anguish that concerns sin, such as the sin of Israel. Jeremiah, he grieved as he considered the sins of the people of Israel and the judgment that was coming. Jeremiah 9:1 says, oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears. Now, he's called the lamenting prophet, right? Lamentations, devoted to his lamentations after he sees the wipeout that the Babylonians did to the people in Jerusalem. Babies crying out, Mama, Mama, I'm hungry. When others are eating their own babies because there's nothing else to eat. Old men are not in the street. They're dead. It's a tragic time and he's lamenting. He foresees that in Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 1. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, he cried, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. To mourn over sin and judgment that's pending. Friends, do you do that for this nation? It's on its way down. The only hope for this nation is not through a president. I don't care who he is. It's in hope in God alone, and it has to repent of its sins and turn to God. Without that, this nation's going down, and it's going down fast right now. Do you mourn over that? Nehemiah did. Daniel did. People of God mourn over their nation, the nation of Israel, when it fell. And they turned eastward and prayed to God. Legitimate warning, concern for spiritual welfare of another believer, for example. That's legitimate warning. For example, Acts chapter 20, verse 31. Paul's concern for the Ephesian believers caused him to mourn night and day for a period of 3 years. I did not cease to admonish each one with tears. In verse 38, he goes on of chapter 20. Because of their great love for him, the elders of Ephesus church later mourned for Paul as he prayed with them on the beach near Miletus. It says there, sorrowing most of all for the words which he spoke, that they would see his face no more. Turn to Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9. This is a familiar story. Jesus was just transfigured before Peter, John, and James. And they come down off the mount. The rest of the disciples, they're dealing with this situation of a man who has a son who's demonized. And they can't set this man free. Jesus asked him, what's going on here? We pick up in verse 20, Mark 9. And they brought to Jesus this demon-possessed man. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell down on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. And he said to his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to the father, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. And immediately the father of the child cried out with tears, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. You ever been there? This is legitimate. Jesus now answers the prayer, sets the man free. And then the last one I want to share as we come to this a conclusion here, and that is repentant, worshipful devotion that caused a woman to mourn over her sins as she went into Simeon, the Pharisee's house, and she washed Jesus' feet with her own tears. And she wiped his feet with her hair. We see the record of this in Luke chapter 7. Well, that Pharisee says, wait a minute. If this is a prophet, he wouldn't let her touch him. What does Jesus do? Well, this proud host, this Pharisee, resented that woman because she was contaminating his house. So Jesus is interrupting the dinner party now along with the woman and said this in verse 47. I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much. But of him who loves little is forgiven little. Because she loves so much, she's forgiven much. Now, what does all this mean? Oh, by the way, I didn't give you another example, but it's good to plug in here right now. And it's found in Matthew 23. And it's also found in John chapter 11. You're familiar with the story, so listen up. Immeasurable divine love of the Lord Jesus Christ. He wept over the death of Lazarus, right? John chapter 11, verse 35. But I also wept over the sinning people of Jerusalem whom he wanted to gather together to him as a mother hen gathers her chicks. But they were not willing. Now, obviously we talked about improper mourning. We can put that over here because that's improper. Let me just say to you, all the proper ones I just gave you are also not what Jesus is talking about on the Sermon on the Mount, except for three of the ones I just mentioned. That has to do with mourning for one's sin and repenting. Mourning over someone else that's sinning. And mourning over judgment that is coming. That is proper mourning. And that's what Jesus is talking about. It's called godly mourning. And next week I'm going to talk more in detail about that.